Okay, Pluto's not a planet, right? I think we're all in agreement about that. Yeah. So that leaves us with 8 planets in our solar system: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. All right, thanks for not turning the episode off, by the way. So stay with me, because what if I were to tell you that there was another planet out there, lurking in the farthest reaches of our solar system, way beyond Pluto? It's so distant and so dark that no telescopes on Earth are yet powerful enough to detect it. Yet.
In the farthest reaches of our solar system, way past Neptune and Pluto, a 9th planet may be lurking. It's predicted to have a mass 5 times that of Earth, and to orbit once every 10,000 years.
A 9th planet? Hey, let's call it Planet 9. Sure, you say. Well, actually, I say the same thing. If we can't see it, how do we know it's there? I know. Math. Yeah, math has found a planet before. Can it do it again? From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm your host, Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up. The show that takes you deep into the cosmos, or just to the telescope in your backyard, to learn more about what makes this amazing universe of ours so great. My guest today is astronomer and mathematician Konstantin Patygin, professor of planetary sciences at Caltech. So I'm really excited to talk with Konstantin Patygin about Planet 9. I mean, he is one of the main people who have predicted its existence, and I got him to almost bet it would be found soon. Almost, real close.
You think Planet 9 exists with 99.8% probability?
Something like that. Yeah, maybe 99. I'll push it high. 99.9% probability.
And many Planet 9 believers out there cite precedents. I mean, Neptune, or as I may call it now, Planet 8, was discovered in 1846 when it was first spotted in a telescope. But 2 mathematicians found Neptune on paper long before then.
A new planet discovered without the use of a telescope or any distant instrument, solely with the help of paper and pen.
So here's what was happening. The astronomers were watching the planet Uranus, which was discovered in 1781, and it was moving in like a funny way. It was as if an unseen object was perturbing, or affecting, its orbit ever so slightly. So when John Couch Adams in England and Urbain Le Verrier in France looked at the problem, they computed an unseen mass would cause such perturbations, and maybe even its possible location in space. Le Verrier went so far as to write to astronomers and in essence claim, hey man, point your telescope there and you'll find a planet. Whew, man, that is some bold statement. And on the night of September 23rd, 1846, an astronomer at the Berlin Observatory, Johann Gottfried Gall, following Le Verrier's instructions, aimed the telescope. And within 1 degree of where Le Verrier predicted,
2.8 billion miles from the sun, a lonely blue world drifts in the darkness.
There it was, a deep blue disk. It was Neptune. Gall, he must have been shocked and awed when he wrote to Le Verrier later. He wrote, "The planet whose place you have computed really exists." This was like math's day in astronomy. And so, could history repeat itself? Could the mathematicians be right about Planet 9?
Hi, my name is Konstantin Patygin, and I'm a professor of planetary astrophysics at Caltech.
Well, Konstantin, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Dean. Pleasure to be here.
Well, back in 2016, you worked with astronomer Mike Brown to try to mathematically prove the existence of a ninth planet, an unseen planet far beyond the orbits of Neptune and Pluto. So first question, Mike, of course, is famous for discovering many dwarf planets that contributed mm-hmm. to Pluto's getting kicked out of the Planet Club. Did Mike come to you because he felt bad about what he did to Pluto and he wanted to make up for it?
Well, that's sort of like a joke story that he likes to tell. But the answer is no. Actually, the answer, this real story is more interesting. He came to me because, I had just started, I had just returned to Caltech, just started my faculty job. And Mike was like, listen, there's this remarkable paper by these guys, Trujillo and Shepard, Chad Trujillo and Scott Shepard. And they are talking about this like alignment of the arguments of perihelion and like, what the hell is that? And like, we should kind of look into this because it looks kind of interesting. And then we, over the course of a year, I started kind of developing theoretical models to try and explain some of this. And we would routinely make fun of the idea that, it would be hilarious is if we wrote a paper about how this is caused by an extra planet in the outer solar system. And as we kind of worked through the various sort of theoretical explanations, and like our takeout blooper reel is full of ideas that didn't work, we were like, okay, as a joke, let's try and put a planet in the outer solar system just to see what would happen. Like, the worst thing that's going to happen is it's going to be ridiculous. And then, like, suddenly, all of these patterns that we were seeing in the outer solar system started to kind of crystallize and come together. And, even going beyond what the original motivation was, like, there's this alignment that I mentioned in this peculiar parameter called the argument of perihelion. But along the way, we discovered there were other patterns as well. And so it was this slow crystallization where we went from an idea that we would just make fun of and joke around about to being like, wait, like, this is the only thing that works. And so, yeah, it was a really fun first year and a half when we kind of led up to that first paper. And of course, we've, over the last decade, worked quite a bit on improving the theory and kind of understanding the mechanisms through which these patterns are shaped much better and discovering new ones along the way.
Wow. And it's so great to see the collaboration between an observational and a theoretical astronomer. It's a beautiful thing putting you two together.
Well, putting the two of us together was hilarious because we spend most of our time just making dumb jokes and not really getting anything done. But I do have to say, I don't think I would have had the expertise of really understanding the observational biases and how these data are collected and like what's really in the data and what does it all means. And I think the reciprocal is true for Mike. I mean, he's not really a theorist by training, but putting us together really led not to so much of a, joyous improvement, but rather the challenge of trying to push one another a little bit. Now that's where I think it's been really fun. And we're an institution that, encourages crazy things. So it's a bit fun to do it here at Caltech.
Can you talk more about the moment you realized that this joke about Planet Nine was actually looking to be possibly true? Like, was there this aha moment where you look at each other and you're like, oh my gosh, this could actually be it?
There really was an aha moment, and it was kind of a slow build towards the aha moment because we were trying to explain what we were seeing in the outer solar system with something, and a planet was doing a good job right off the bat. But it's much easier to explain what you already know to be true than to predict something and then kind of go test it. So one of the things that I kept seeing in the simulations was that, the eccentric orbit of Planet Nine was twisting some of the distant bodies out of alignment with the plane of the solar system and kind of turning them onto these perpendicular orbits. And I thought to myself, well, this would be a good prediction. We could say, all right, here's what we've explained. But if this is true, then if you go out and look, you should see these, you know, perpendicular long period orbits. And, you know, we would kind of have our daily chats with Mike, and you know, he was in his office. So I walked over to him. I was like, listen, I think I found something like that could be an awesome prediction. And he was like, okay, let's take a look. And then he was like, wait, I think like Dr. 14 is like this. And you know, Kuiper Belt objects have these license plates that are usually a year and then followed by two letters and then some more numbers. And he's like, Dr., I forgot the exact name, but he kept referring to some object that was Dr. It was a DR was in the license plate. And we looked, and indeed there had been one of these bodies detected that looked exactly like something that was coming out of the simulation. Now, of course, I was completely unaware of it, right? You know, I'm just doing my theoretical world. Mike was, of course, the observer of the two of us. So he got his eye on the pulse of what's, you know, what's in the data. And then we're like, okay, let's look, dig some more in the data. And turned out there had been the census of such bodies already detected. And we said, all right, let's do this right now. Let's overplot the simulation product, the kind of outcome, the synthetic expectation of where these things should be according to the model. And let's just like overplot them on where the real objects are. And seeing them appear on the screen, you know, kind of where the clouds of simulated data were, like, oh my God, like, I think this might be for real. Like this is, they kind of graduated in our minds from just something that we sort of make fun of and speculate and sort of just are in no rush to get done, so to speak, to this might actually be there, you know?
Well, I gotta be the skeptic here partially, you know, because it's been 9 years since you proposed Planet Nine and it's still remaining undetected. So from your point of view, is it just like we're waiting for our technology to advance far enough? Or are you having any doubts? You know, as a mathematician, what percentage of certainty are you that Planet Nine exists? Oh, if you want to be a betting person.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let me answer maybe the first question first of like, yeah, it's been 9 years. Where the hell is Planet Nine? Well, first of all, in 2016, I said, this is going to take at least a decade. And I'm on record all over the place saying that because you're looking for one thing, right? This is a very strange astronomical search. Usually in astronomy, you look for a population of bodies and you hope to capture some fraction of it. Here, there's one little dim star and it's dim as hell. I mean, it's visual magnitude, probably 24. It's right at the edge of what can be done with sort of the best telescopes, like say the Subaru telescope. And critically, we don't know where to look for it. Like we can compute the orbit and the mass. And being a theorist, I really did not appreciate the extent to which you are not in control when you're observing, right? Like doing theory, you know, weather is bad, is great. You sit at home, drink some wine, do some math, you know, relax. When you're observing, you're completely, you know, at the whelm of suddenly the atmosphere became turbulent and your seeing is way low. Suddenly the telescope broke or the fog rolled in or somebody, you know, tried to hike Mauna Kea and got hurt. And so the ambulance is now there to rescue them. So, you know, there's a strobing red light that is, you know, obscuring all the observations. So all of this stuff has made it so that our search efficiency was probably 20%, maybe 25%. So we're like, all right, we're just going to wait for LSST, Vera Rubin Observatory, to come online. And it just did last month. And as they start to collect real data, right, that will be, I think, a turning point for all of this business. All right, so I think the observational story has been on hold for 4 or 5 years now, and that's about to change.
Well, I want to go a little bit farther afield. We've had some very interesting interstellar visitors come through our solar system lately. You know, I think the object Oumuamua made headlines, and now we've got 3-Eye Atlas passing through our solar system. How exciting are these for somebody in your field to see these kind of interstellar interlopers coming through our solar system?
Well, look, first and foremost, their existence is not at all a surprise. Now, what was quite strange about Oumuamua was the kind of absence of a coma and the presence of non-gravitational acceleration. Right, that's the thing that kind of fed so much of the excitement, is trying to figure that out. Because usual comets have non-gravitational acceleration galore, but they also show a coma. So after the detection of Oumuamua, there was this lingering question, are all interstellar comets going to be this weird? And then the next one comes in, I don't remember exactly what year it was, and it was just the most normal looking solar system comet ever. And that really, I think, adds to the mystery of the first objects.
Constantine, thanks so much for joining me today. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Dean. Appreciate it.
Well, Constantine mentioned three interstellar visitors that we've had so far that have come through our solar system. These are objects whose journey originated from distant stars and have only recently wandered into our neighborhood. They are 1-Eye Oumuamua, that's the name of the object. It's the object that sparked curiosity not only because it was first, but because it behaved so strangely and sparked alien ideas. Don't worry. We'll do a whole episode on it soon. But for now, let's go on to number two. That was 2-Eye Borisov. That's the second interstellar object. This looked to be like a typical, but in fact turned out to be a rogue comet. It was on a trajectory that will pass through, not hang around the sun. And some astronomers believe Borisov was ejected from a star system about 13 light years away. And that leaves 3-Eye Atlas, the third of its kind, passing through. The thing with interstellar interlopers is that we only recently have the technology to detect them. And the telescope that can help maybe in the future, a telescope I may or may not have a crush on, the Vera Rubin telescope, could unlock and discover so many more of these objects. I think it's going to keep people like Constantine busy for the rest of our lives. But come on, let's get with this. Let's find this ninth planet already. Planet 9. Looking Up with Dean Regas is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds and I created the podcast in 2017. Ella Rowan and Carlos Lopez Cornu produce and edit our show and have computed the gravitational pull this episode will have on you. It's massive. Janelle Walton is our vice president of content, and Ronnie Salerno is our digital platforms manager. Our theme song is Possible Light by Ziv Moran. Our social media coordinator is Hannah McFarlane, and our cover art is by Nicole Tiffany. I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.